First case is People versus Santana, case number 09-SC-808. Are both parties ready? Just a reminder, 30 minutes aside, please state your name at the time you start your argument, because we record it. And if you want to reserve time, you'll have to keep track of your time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White. My attorney registration number is 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. The issues presented here stem from the prosecutor's cross-examination questions and subsequent comments during closing argument regarding a defense expert witness, specifically at the defendant's trial for distribution of a Schedule II controlled substance, cocaine. The prosecution's evidence included the results of presumptive testing from an investigator as well as a chemist that were conducted on the substance that the defendant sold to the undercover officer. That testing indicated the presence of cocaine. The defendant called an expert in chemistry who was not endorsed until the second day of trial, who testified that the tests were not scientifically valid and did not conclusively confirm that the substance was in fact cocaine. On cross-examination, the prosecutor questioned the expert and established that the expert had not personally tested the substance, even though it was available, and therefore he had the opportunity to do so. Based on the nature of this case, I would like to discuss the issues somewhat out of order as presented in the opening brief, and talk first about whether there was any error. Then I would like to talk about if there was error, what type of error it was, and what standard of review the people believe should apply. Here, the questions and statements were not erroneous. When looked at in context, the prosecutor's questions and subsequent comments were intended to clarify the scope of the expert's testimony and knowledge. The prosecutor was trying to effectively cross-examine this expert, who had testified that the tests were not scientifically valid and did not conclusively show that the substance was cocaine. It is important to note that in reviewing the record, I determined that this expert was endorsed on the second day of trial after the prosecution had rested. Therefore, the prosecutor had no previous knowledge about this witness or notice as to what he would testify to.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that's true, but what difference do you think that makes to the questions and the answers on the cross-examination?
I think in ultimately giving the trial court the abuse of discretion, I think that the fact that this prosecution had no notice and that the defense did not introduce this, did not endorse this expert until the second day of trial, it tends to leave more credence to the trial court's determination here. So it is well established.
What specific determination? I'm sorry.
In leading to the fact that there was no burden shifting in this case. So I think in looking at the fact that this prosecutor was trying to cross-examine this expert and the fact that there was absolutely no notice to the prosecution to know what they would testify to, I think that that gives a little more credence to the trial court's determination here. So it is well established that prosecutors can comment on the evidence and are afforded wide latitude in closing argument as to comment on the strength or weakness of the evidence as well as to make any reasonable inferences. Further, a prosecutor can alert the jury to circumstances that raise questions or cast doubt on the witness's testimony. Many Colorado cases hold that a prosecutor's comments on the lack of evidence to support a defense theory does not necessarily shift the burden of proof. And further, other courts have specifically found that the prosecution does not shift the burden of proof to the defendant by implying that the defendant should have or could have requested scientific testing. Here, I think, again, when looked at in context, this was not intended to show that the defendant had any obligation to test the substance or any obligation to prove his innocence. I think that this was intended to show that the witness had no actual involvement in this case and did not know what specific tests either the investigator or the chemist had conducted on the substance. The prosecutor tried to establish that the substance was available to the expert and further that the expert was qualified and had the capability to perform such testing. And I think that in effect, the prosecutor wanted to show that this expert had simply reviewed the documents that were already admitted and gave the same conclusions and therefore offered nothing additional to the jury.
So what was the gist of this expert's testimony?
Basically, this expert said that the presumptive testing was not conclusive. It did not show, in fact, that this was cocaine. So that was the exact same thing as the investigator testified, and that the documents that the chemist, that showed the results of the chemist analysis had showed as well.
That fairly raised the issue of what the substance was?
I think it's important to note that the prosecution never stated that this presumptive testing was conclusive. And so both the investigator, based on his analysis, and then the chemist's analysis, indicated the presence of cocaine. And the prosecutor never stated that this was conclusively cocaine.
So the purpose of the defense expert's testimony, of course, was then to raise an inference of reasonable doubt as to whether, in fact, the substance was cocaine, correct?
Exactly.
All right. So given that, would, if the statement had been from the prosecutor that Dr. Lance didn't prove that it wasn't cocaine, would that have been improper?
I think that that's what they were trying to effectively show, that this witness did not show that this was, they could not conclusively state that this was not cocaine, just as the prosecution could not affirmatively state, granted there's other evidence to look at, but for this specific testing, the prosecution could not affirmatively state that this was cocaine. It was just the presumption that the presence of cocaine was there,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Had the prosecutor said instead, Dr. Lance didn't prove that this wasn't cocaine, are you saying that, that statement would not be an improper shifting of the burden of proof?
I think that that's what the prosecutor was trying to get at, and I agree that I think that they said it a bit inartfully, but I think that they were trying to say, because if you look at the testimony from Dr. Lance, he says that this, some of this looks like cocaine when he's looking at the substance and some of it doesn't. So I think that the prosecutor was just simply trying to get him to say, we don't know conclusively that it is, just as we don't know conclusively that it isn't. So I think, yes, in some respects that wouldn't be burden shifting, but I think that we have that here. I think that that's the inference that the prosecution is trying to make, is that you can't affirmatively prove that it's not. And so just, I think that that goes to rebutting the expert's testimony with respect to whether or not there was a reasonable doubt here.
I don't think that that somehow suggests that, in fact, the defense had some burden to, in fact, show that it wasn't cocaine.
I don't. I think that this was simply trying to get at the actual expert's knowledge and saying you had an opportunity, this was available to you, but you don't have any actual knowledge in this case. And I think that that's what they were really trying to get at, is you are testifying to the same thing that our witness is testifying, that basically you're testifying to the same thing that the chemist has done. You're not bringing anything additional that you would have personal knowledge regarding this substance.
Just a part of the question was, you weren't asked to do this, right?
Right.
And you could have done it.
And I think the cop
couldn't have done it, right? Because he wasn't qualified. He just did the presumptive testing.
Exactly. But the chemist could have also, the police chemist could have, the laboratory could have done conclusive testing as well.
Could I ask one question? I haven't had time to look at the record yet, but just from y'all's briefs, it seemed to me one of the things that was being brought out on cross-examination was, and is this right, that the defense expert didn't know precisely what kind of test was done?
Right. I think the record is a bit confusing in respect to that, because there's the terms presumptive and preliminary that are sort of used interchangeably, and I think all of the tests that were done fall under the umbrella of a presumptive test. The officer looked at the substance and found that it was similar in texture and appearance to cocaine, and then they conducted a further presumptive test, the officer did, and then sent it on to the chemist, who did a further presumptive test that showed that the preliminary analysis indicated the presence of cocaine. So I think all of the terms basically are trying to, I think that the questions went to the chemist, or the expert had no idea what specific tests the officer or the chemist had done.
So was he just testifying, well, when we use the term presumptive, usually we mean some kind of test that can point that way but doesn't rule for certain?
I think that's what they were trying to use him to show, is that the presumptive testing does not mean conclusive.
I don't think I've ever encountered this before. Of course, the prosecution would have the burden of proof of showing that it is cocaine, right?
Right.
That it is an illegal substance? Doesn't this kind of question become more problematical in a case where the prosecution arguably hasn't sustained that burden?
Well, and I think here, there's a lot of evidence that I think will show that this was cocaine. But I think it's not problematic in the fact that scientific testing is not required and a substance isn't required to be introduced into evidence in order for the prosecution to prove that it is a controlled substance. And circumstantial evidence, which I think was sufficient and overwhelming in this case, is sufficient to meet the prosecution's burden.
Was there any, at trial, did anything ever come out about why this was not tested further?
No, and I think there might have been the intention to do a conclusive testing and it just was not performed. But again, I don't think I think that would go to pretty much the weight of this testimony and encompassing with all of the other overwhelming evidence against the defendant. So I think that here the trial court properly concluded that the challenged evidence and arguments would not be interpreted to the jury as burden shifting. And I think that this is why the abuse of discretion standard must be applied first. A trial court is in a better position than a reviewing court.
Before you start arguing about the standard for a motion for mistrial, the Court of Appeals, I think, said that, you know, that was the basis of the appeal, was the denial of the motion for mistrial. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious whether that's entirely accurate and an appeal was not brought from the denial of the objection, the evidentiary issue, or with regard to closing argument?
I think at each point, defense counsel objected and then requested a mistrial during the discussion with the trial court.
I understand that. I'm talking about what was appealed by the defense to the Court of Appeals. Only the motion for mistrial?
The mistrial, and then at the end, the judgment of acquittal. And there were five issues that were raised on appeal. One involved a defense of entrapment, the mistrial, the judgment of acquittal, and I believe the investigator's testimony as well. So the mistrial motion was appealed, and then the judgment of acquittal, the denial of that at the conclusion of the prosecution's evidence. So again, I think the trial court, with respect to what standard of review should be applied, I think a trial court is in a much better position than an appellate court to determine and evaluate any adverse effect of any possible irregularity on the jury. So the appellate court should review the denial of a mistrial for abuse of discretion, and it must decide the appropriateness of that mistrial based on the facts before the trial court at the time of the motion.
Please go ahead.
You know, as I read the whole Court of Appeals opinion, I think that one sentence is sort of taken a little bit out of context. I mean, it seems to me they do address the proper standard.
They do, and I think
so. What difference? I guess let's assume that's correct. I mean, the law is clear that you look at whether it's error, abuse of discretion, and if it's constitutional error, then you apply that standard.
Right.
So I kind of think the opinion. If you ask me, the opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. I've only been wrong a couple of times today. I think that opinion really does say that anyway.
And I agree that they begin their analysis by talking about the abuse of discretion. The Court of Appeals.
So let's assume that to be the case.
But I
don't think this court's going to ever say otherwise.
Okay.
So where does that put us?
Well, I think in reviewing first for the abuse of discretion, we need to look at, and I think here the trial court did not abuse its discretion. So if we're looking at abuse of discretion first, before the constitutional...
Yeah, I understand. You want us to say it's okay.
Yes.
All right. But let's assume for a second we might disagree with you.
Right.
We think it shifted the burden of proof.
Okay.
And what's the issue? Could you discuss harmless error?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So assuming that there was error in the trial court abuse of discretion, I think any error was harmless. I think importantly, again, when looked at in context, the complaint of questions and statements were not necessarily of a constitutional dimension. I think that these can be interpreted as simply an evidentiary determination. However, under either a constitutional or non-constitutional standard, any error was harmless. And again, the Court of Appeals opinion relies heavily on scientific testing, finding that the evidence on whether the substance was actually crack cocaine was surprisingly somewhat thin. However, such evidence is not required, and again, the people do not need to admit the substance into evidence to prove that it is a controlled substance. And I think here the evidence against the defendant was overwhelming and leads to the conclusion that the substance was crack cocaine. Here, the defendant approached the undercover officer by waving him down in an area known for drug use and asked him if he would like to purchase drugs. The defendant then got into the car with the investigator and told him specifically where to drive to obtain those drugs. The defendant entered a residence with the investigator's money and returned with a single whitened colored rock that looked like cocaine to the trained and qualified officer, and later suggested the presence of cocaine. The defendant then took more money and completed a second similar transaction. And later, the defendant told another police officer that he had purchased crack cocaine from this specific house four times in the previous week. So I think if the error is not of a constitutional dimension and subject to harmless error, I think that based on all of this evidence against the defendant, any error did not substantially influence the verdict or affect the fairness of the proceedings.
I don't really want to argue with you, but the one thing that bothers me about that analysis, which is follows the Court of Appeals thing, is that many moons ago, there were cases where people sold phony crack cocaine and phony cocaine, white powder, to undercover officers, and it was just that, not a controlled substance. How do you factor that in?
Well, I think that, again, you have to look at the overwhelming evidence here in this case, and the fact that...
Well, no, I mean the defendant actually wants the cop to believe, wants the buyer to believe that you're getting cocaine, instead you're getting...
Well, we had a case this morning that was a fake truck that led to that murder.
Well, and I think, you know, again, you have a situation where we do have presumptive testing that indicates the presence of cocaine. And while there are some false positives that come out of that testing, that really is the intention of that testing is to eliminate substances that would look like...
So your answer to that kind of argument is basically the presumptive test, well, field test.
And I also think, you know, the amount of money that was transferred, the substance that was given to the officer who has done over 30 of these transactions and recognizes crack cocaine, I think all of that, including the defendant's actual statement that he had purchased crack cocaine four times previously from this specific house and that there's drug dealers inside this home, I think all of that leads to the compulsion that this is crack cocaine. The conclusion, excuse me.
I don't understand that. I really don't.
I think if you...
Because there's a lot of fraud that goes on in this stuff, too. I mean, I'm stuck on the problem of why some better test isn't required here. That may not be the main issue here, but it certainly seems to go to the harmless error question.
Well, I think it does go to the harmless error question, but I think the presumptive testing gives the inference that this is crack cocaine. And conclusive testing is, as the expert testified, very costly. And so a lot of times, and especially in a situation like this where the evidence is overwhelming, this evidence isn't necessary. And there are many cases that hold that you don't even need the controlled substance, and circumstantial evidence is sufficient to support the burden. So I think all of this is a jury determination as to whether or not the prosecution has met their burden beyond to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think here, with all of this evidence, and with the jury instructions on the burden of proof and the presumption of innocence, which there's no indication that the jury ignored, I think any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt if this was a constitutional issue. And so therefore, I would, as the dissent concluded, I don't think that there is any probability that the evidence complained of contributed to the defendant's conviction.
That's a question, too, about the record. Was there any theory of the case instruction given? What was the theory of the case?
I think his theory, the defense theory, was that this might not be crack cocaine.
And so I think reasonable that, again, doubt? Like,
that goes to...
Might not be, meaning it was a counterfeit drug, or...
No, I think any? That they basically, the defense theory was that the prosecution has not conclusively shown that this is not...
So there was no theory that I was passing a false drug, or I was passing something that wasn't a drug. The theory was, and was there actually a theory of the case instruction, or was it simply relying on the prosecution having failed to meet their burden to prove this was a drug?
Based on my recollection, I believe it was simply the standard instructions that would show that the prosecution has to meet their burden beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, I'm curious about this interplay between the two standards of review, mm-hmm. this abuse of discretion for reviewing the motion for mistrial, and then peering into the nature of the underlying error. And I'm a little confused about how you've presented it. You obviously wish that this court would look at the abuse of discretion standard first, but then you seem to likewise link it to say, once you get past that, and assuming I'm perhaps putting words in your mouth, but it seemed to be following you to say, if there is an abuse of discretion, then we look at the nature of the error, and from there we determine if it's constitutional error, we apply a constitutional harmless error standard. If it's non-constitutional error, regular harmless error standard.
Right.
Am I following you correctly?
That's, yes.
Okay. How then is the Court of Appeals going at this improperly? Because it seems to sort of do the same thing. It is really focused on the nature of the underlying error. Why is that a problem?
Well, and I think it might not necessarily be a problem. I think, and I understand the Court of Appeals opinion talks about abuse of discretion and then the constitutional error. However, in their conclusion, they state that in this particular situation, instead of the abuse of discretion review, and they go through a couple of cases that do the same thing, we are going to apply a constitutional harmless error standard instead of the abuse of discretion review. And that, to me, is problematic because I think it puts, you know, the trial, if you collapse the two reviews into each other, I think you really take away that deference that we give to the trial court, especially in a situation like this, where the observations and perceptions of the trial court are really key in making this determination. And so while the Court of Appeals appears to go through the abuse of discretion and constitutional harmless error standard or harmless error standard, I think they really collapse the two into each other, which I think is problematic in the fact that a trial court, in reading this opinion, may try to determine if any error is of, you know, is constitutional harmless error in the middle of trial. And I understand, you know, trial court may not necessarily do that, but I think, you know, without having the benefit of the whole record, this may lead to incorrect determinations from a trial court without looking to sufficient alternative remedies.
I'm still a little puzzled. Would the Court of Appeals opinion satisfy you with respect to the order of reviews, forgetting about whether they're right on that it's error to begin with mm-hmm. and that it's not harmless? Would it satisfy you if at the end of the opinion they basically said, because it's not harmless, it was therefore an abuse of discretion, returning to the original standard that you think they properly commenced with?
As if they flipped the two, constitutional
I guess if they said, because it's not harmless, mm-hmm. it therefore was abuse of discretion to deny mistrial.
But I think I think I would probably be in the same situation and have troubles with the conclusion. But I feel that if you don't review the abuse of discretion first and go directly to harmless error, or if you review constitutional or harmless error first, you really eliminate the abuse of discretion standard, because if you find that the error was...
So you think that the proper review is a determination of whether it's an abuse of discretion, and then if it is an abuse of discretion, then you go to address whether it's harmless.
Yes, based on the underlying error, you would determine, basically, you would use either the constitutional harmless error or harmless error analysis, depending on whether or not it's constitutional.
Does that all presume, were you just leaving out a step that you first have to decide whether it's error?
Yes, I think that is, so, you have to determine whether or not the trial court abused discretion in determining that it is not error.
Let me try to separate those two out. If it were not error to admit the evidence, if the evidence was not improperly admitted,
then we don't get...
Could it ever be an abuse of discretion?
I think...
Why would we be talking about this trial?
If there was no error in the admission of this, I think... That's the end of the analysis. There's no reason to look at whether, and I think you tend for evidentiary determinations to look at abuse of discretion inherently when looking at whether or not there was error and determining.
The reason I ask that is whether the error was whether the evidence was admitted improperly is an abuse of discretion standard itself, right?
Right.
Is that different from abuse of discretion in denying a mistrial? I mean, presumably, they're different problems. The first problem you have is was this error evidence improperly admitted?
Right.
Go ahead.
I mean, I believe that, and I'm hoping I'm understanding your question correctly, but I think When you look at other admissions of evidence, we don't really have the necessity to look at the impact on the jury always. It's whether evidence is admissible or not. Here, the trial court is able to watch the jury and listen to all of this testimony and determine whether or not this is impacting the jury. And I think that is why we need to, you know, give the trial court that deference in reviewing this for an abuse of discretion first, in order to have that determination that if there is then error and the trial court then abuses discretion, then we would get to what type of error. But I think it's a very different line with some other admission or other evidentiary determinations than the one that we have here.
Just one little step further. All right, even if you have error in admitting evidence, if it would not be reversible error, mm-hmm. would we be concerned with whether the judge abused his discretion in granting a mistrial, in failing to grant a mistrial? Wouldn't the question of mistrial only come in if
it was
the question is whether the judge improperly tried to cure this error by giving a curative instruction or something
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely, and I think you would also look at the frequency or the severity of the conduct or the possible misconduct in order to make that determination. So I don't think you necessarily have to get to that point if you determine that there might be error, but the trial court did not abuse its discretion in selecting the remedy that it chose.
So I'm sorry to keep, I'm still sort of wrestling with this myself, but based on the colloquy you've just had, it suggests that in fact you should look at the underlying error first.
But I think that removes that discretion that we really need to look at first. If you're determining that there's error and the trial court abused its discretion by either not selecting the proper remedy or not giving a remedy, and I have to point out that here the trial court offered a limiting instruction. And I think it's important to note that defense counsel chose not to pursue this. And so the trial court, you know, while determining that this was not error, the trial court said,
I'm sorry, I missed that completely in the reading. There was an offer for a limited instruction?
The trial court offered to renew the affirmation that the defendant has no burden in the case.
When, during closing or during the cross?
It was actually after the second objection.
During the cross-examination.
And the trial court said, if necessary, I will renew the affirmation and basically give the standard of review or the jury instruction regarding the burden of proof. And defense counsel did not pursue that offered remedy. And so I think that in looking, if there was no error, we don't necessarily get to abuse of discretion because the trial court properly made the selection of what remedy would have possibly cured any of this alleged prejudice.
So what kind of duty do you think is on the defense to accept that offer or just stand silent and see if the judge gives it?
I think that they absolutely should make an
effort. They okay.
Pursue that remedy.
They're required to ask for such a limiting instruction?
I think it, you know, tends to show that maybe defense counsel wasn't as concerned and was just objecting. And I think that, you know, they should have said, yes, I would like that.
Basically, it's a double-edged sword. You know, if you ask for a limiting instruction, you re-emphasize whatever the error you think.
Well, that's it. I'm precisely getting at the matter of strategy that may be involved in not asking
and not
for
not selecting that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if defense counsel was very concerned about this, that was a possible remedy that the trial court offered. If there are no further questions, I would reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Goldstein. My attorney registration number is 24658. I would like to address the issues in reverse order of the state. I believe that we have to address the standard of review before we can get to whether or not there was actually harmless error. It's Mr. Santana's position that the Court of Appeals properly reviewed this under a constitutional harmless error standard, and the reason is that repeatedly through trial, defense counsel alerted the trial court that this was, the prosecutor was engaging in improper burden shifting by suggesting and positing with the jury that Mr. Santana has a duty or an obligation to test the illicit substance.
Can I ask you a question? We keep talking about impermissible burden shifting there, and I understand we sort of use the term in a shorthand, but in what sense can asking a question ever shift the burden? And let me follow up only by saying, with regard, apropos of the last part of discussion we had here, if the jury is instructed that whatever the prosecutor asks does not shift the burden and the people still have the burden, does that solve the problem?
How I would answer that, Your Honor, is that in this case, there were no limiting instructions given, and the trial court only gave the standard burden of proof instruction at the close of evidence in the jury instructions. And so I think in this case, it's very obvious that the jury was posited with the suggestion that Mr. Santana had a duty or an obligation to test it. What I think is noteworthy from the Court of Appeals opinion is that Dr. Lance was the only expert who testified, and he pretty much testified unrefuted that you could not tell from the presumptive test that this was in fact crack cocaine. And so, yes, the evidence was thin on whether the substance was crack.
Do you understand the record the same way your opposing counsel does, that the judge offered to give such an instruction?
I believe the judge did offer to give an instruction. Uh-huh. And as a defense lawyer, I think what happens is you're sitting in trial, you've made an objection, you've asked for a mistrial because you realize this is of constitutional magnitude, and the court says, I'm not granting the mistrial, do you want me to give a limiting instruction? And so then you're stuck with, do I want to ring the bell again and let the jury know that I really have a problem with this piece of evidence?
That makes perfect sense, but what's the effect of that? If defense counsel makes the tactical choice that he'd rather go for this and see if it amounts to error without trying to correct it and see if he can get a reversal, or take the chance by asking for a curative instruction that may emphasize it, how should we look at that in reviewing it?
Well, in some ways it is a catch-22. However, I would note that in a couple of the cases that the state cited, U.S. v. Wimbley and Myers v. State, for the proposition that commenting on the defendant not presenting evidence or testing the evidence, that was not an improper comment. In the first case, U.S. v. Wimbley, the court noted that the trial court repeatedly admonished the jury regarding the burden of proof and the presumption of innocence. Also in U.S. v. Wimbley, which I think is quite telling, the defendant in that case stipulated that the substance at issue was in fact crack cocaine, and stipulated that to the quantity. On top of that, there was a recording of the controlled purchase of the crack cocaine. And so then what happened is they're in closing arguments, and defense counsel says, you know, they didn't test the baggies for fingerprints. There was no DNA. It was only in rebuttal closing arguments that the prosecutor stood up and said, what? You know, we put up this evidence. They should have tested the baggies. And that was the extent of that comment. And so I think U.S. v. Wimbley is very much distinguishable from the facts in our case, where there were no limiting instructions whatsoever regarding this. And in fact, the prosecutor repeatedly implied and posited with the jury that there was a duty of Mr. Santana to test the substance, and in fact did not test the substance.
It occurs to me that, I don't know if this is right, but in thinking about the cross-examination, that's an evidentiary issue initially. If it's improper, forgetting the Constitution just for a second, or what the basis is, that's going to be viewed as an abuse of discretion, right? Before you get into the complicated analysis that has been asked. Basically, a judge's ruling on evidence is going to be reviewed on appeal for whether or not it's abuse of discretion, right?
Let me just finish. I'm sorry.
So that leans more the cross-examination, okay, the record is made and so forth. that's now the closing argument, that seems to me much more like a question of law, where the prosecutor says they didn't come and tell you any analysis that they did. They didn't prove to you that it was something else. That, to me, is more clearly a legal question, and I'm wondering how we should think about that. I mean, you put them both together, and so it's a little confusing. You have the evidentiary issue, and then you have the closing argument, which is much more, I mean, the thing is objected to, but now we're talking more clearly, I think, in terms of the jury's eyes about a legal issue, the shifting of a constitutional issue, really, shifting the burden, or I don't know, that's what at least a way of looking at it.
I understand the court's question. The way I can best respond to it is, in my research of the cases, it seemed like many of the courts are, when they're addressing such an issue where it's initially an evidentiary ruling, but then they also realize that there are constitutional underpinnings to that evidentiary objection. And so when the Court of Appeals, in some of the cases that I reviewed, I called it a dual standard of review. They essentially analyzed the problem under both an abuse of discretion standard and also a constitutional harmless error standard. And to address your questions, Justice Coates, I think that you have to start with a constitutional harmless error standard. And if there is no constitutional harmless error, then it necessarily shows that there is no abuse of discretion. But I don't think you can start with an abuse of discretion standard and then see whether or not there was constitutional harmless error, because you would never get to the constitutional harmless error. And certainly...
Why not?
I think if you...
Yes, it was error. How we find this constitutional...
Well...
What's to prohibit that?
If I understood the court correctly, I think if you look at first whether it's an abuse of discretion standard, it's a much more, what's the word, a flexible or it's much more difficult to show that the trial court evidentiary ruling was manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair.
Sure.
You're not even looking at the constitutional issue, and I think because we're here to ensure that a defendant has the right to a fair trial, a constitutional right to a fair trial, you must start with the higher standard of review, which is a constitutional harmless error standard.
Before you catch your breath and start off in a different direction, let me just piggyback off a little bit of what Justice Bender was asking you about, the closing argument part as distinguished from mistrial at trial. You both, or one of you, cited the old our old People v. Medina case about it's okay for the prosecutor to comment on the defendant's failure to produce an alibi witness that he presumably could produce, as long as it's clear the jury is not being told that the defendant has an obligation to prove his innocence, rather than the other way around. That seems to be in stark contrast to something that's a very express constitutional right, like you have a right to testify. We make clear it would be a violation, it would be a constitutional violation to comment on the defendant's failure to testify. But with regard to putting on evidence that might suggest a shifting of burden, we seem to have said that's not a constitutional problem unless you've communicated to the jury that the burden is shifted. So are we always faced with this question first about whether the jury was properly instructed? Were they instructed that that the burden had not shifted? And is that the central factor that we should be looking at with regard to the closing argument statement?
The prosecutor's closing argument was problematic because he then essentially referred back to his questions during cross-examination, which posited with the jury that Mr. Santana's expert had not tested the evidence, even though he had the ability to do so. And in this case, again, there were just the standard jury instructions that were submitted regarding the burden of proof and the presumption of innocence. There were no limiting instructions. The trial court did not at any time in the middle of trial sua sponte give a limiting instruction or turn to the jury and tell them, you know, Mr. Santana never has the burden or obligation to test evidence or to prove his innocence.
But what happened in terms of the colloquy between the court and the defense lawyer in closing argument?
I think the trial counsel vociferously went up to the bench and was very upset that the prosecutor again was...
What was the request?
He asked for a mistrial.
And what did the judge say?
I'm sorry.
And what did the judge say? I'm sorry.
The judge said it was just a comment, a proper comment upon
on the evidence. Was there offer of limiting instruction at that time?
There was not.
Yeah, that seems to be the real crux of this case, is that mistrial is a remedy. It's very rarely granted. And it looks to me like the defense could have asked for the curative instruction. It's not clear to me that just the standard instruction wouldn't do it. The judge basically said you've got to find beyond a reasonable doubt and that the prosecution has the burden. So
mistrial is the most drastic of remedies, certainly, but I think when you look at the record on this case, which shows that the actual evidence, whether or not the state had proven the element, whether this substance was in fact crack cocaine, was thin. And in fact, Dr. Lance testified that really the only way to definitively prove whether the substance was crack cocaine was to do something called a mass spectrometry test. And that was not done. And again, we don't know why the state did not.
Does the state usually do that?
I believe that's quite usual to have the Colorado Bureau.
Like, I've never seen a case like this where, you know, it could be a fake drug and it was all set up by the cops in the first place. You know, it's just, you know, they really wanted it to be crack cocaine, but maybe they didn't really show that.
I think it's unusual. I think certainly in my briefs, I posited that Mr. Santana could have been really selling sugar. But we don't know because there was no testing, or I should say there was no definitive testing of the substance. To get back to your earlier question is, there was no limiting instruction. And while it's true that a mistrial is a most drastic remedy, I think clearly it was warranted in this case, given the paucity of evidence against Mr. Santana. I think because the prosecutor knew he had really nothing to refute the defendant's expert, Dr. Lance, who in reading his testimony, he came across as quite credible. And if I recall correctly, I don't believe he was even objected to as an expert. And so I think then what happens is we're in closing arguments and the prosecutor turns on the heat and really points to what he believes is one of his strongest issues, is that Mr. Santana's expert did not test the evidence. So again, this is not just really commenting upon the evidence, the trial court said, but instead it's turning it on its head and telling the jury, look, Mr. Santana did not prove to you it's not crack cocaine, which is then impermissibly shifting the burden to Mr. Santana.
So can I just stop you there and just follow up with your characterization of the cross-examination and then the closing statement? Is it your position that the prosecution just simply cannot ask a question, or that a series of questions that would point out to the jury that, boy, this expert doesn't have any firsthand knowledge? Or is it that the questions here were just improperly phrased? And if they were improperly phrased, can you tell me what the prosecution could have asked properly to bring the point out?
I think in this particular case, the questions that the prosecutor asked were improper because they went right to the point that he could have tested the substances, didn't, and then he moved on. I think Certainly, there are cases that show that the prosecutors properly can comment upon the lack of evidence. For instance, in Myers v. State, they upheld the defendant's conviction and found that the prosecutor did not engage in improper burden shifting, commenting upon the failure to test the evidence. But it was after reviewing the whole trial record and showing that it was really just a small, minor issue that the prosecutor raised in closing arguments. And I think the problem here is that in cross-examination, the prosecutor asked twice in two different colloquies whether or not Dr. Lance had tested the substance. Defense counsel immediately objected, moved to approach the bench, and at that after the first colloquy between the expert and the prosecutor, they moved to approach the bench. And at that time, it seemed like the trial court acknowledged this is problematic and said, well, I don't think the prosecutor is going to go there because he knows that this is going to result in an objection and move for a mistrial. So I think at that point, the trial lawyer thought, the trial court understands my concerns about this line of questioning, and that's not going to be an issue. And then immediately after sitting down, the prosecutor got back up and asked basically another similar question, and that raised the second objection and the move to approach the
bench. So is it the repetition of the question, not the nature of the question?
No, I think it's the repetition and the nature of the
okay
question.
So that gets back to my question. Couldn't you ask, can what is the proper way in your view that a question could be asked that would bring out the fact that the expert did not test, had no firsthand knowledge of the testing? How could you ask that question?
I don't think the prosecutor can, because I think that when you ask, you're asking the defendant's expert why they did not do something. You are then shifting the burden to the defendant to affirmatively prove his innocence.
So there's no way for the prosecution to point out that the expert did not test.
Ms. Carlson, unless it's opened up.
Okay.
Unless it's opened up by the direct examination, it exceeds the scope of the direct, right? Because all the expert is testifying to is that the field testing isn't the greatest thing since indoor plumbing, right?
Exactly. And I think if a CBI chemist had testified and talked about certain testing or whatnot, then I think the jury would be given a fuller picture of what
That's true, but that's not really what's at issue here.
But, well, I think in this case, then why that's important, though, is because we were just left with the defendant's expert who was testifying, and then the prosecutor who really had nothing to refute Dr. Lance's testimony, then just kind of left it as, well, you didn't do anything, so you can't, essentially prove that it's not crack cocaine.
Let me ask you a question coming at it from a different direction. I mean, the expert certainly had to be qualified under 702 to render an opinion, right? And
yes.
Part of that qualification is the basis of his opinion under 703, right?
Yeah.
And the basis of his opinion under 703 would include both what he did and he ostensibly didn't do in order to formulate his opinion. So a question like this, so is that all you did in order to formulate this opinion would be perfectly proper?
I think if that's all you did, but I think it went more to the fact that Mr. Santana then did not have the evidence to prove that it was not crack cocaine.
What about a question then? He says, well, that's all you did, and so let me just make sure I understand correctly. You didn't actually test the drugs yourself. Would that be a fair question? Because under 703, what you're doing is testing the limits and extent and the foundation for the expert's opinion.
I understand the court's question, but if you read the closing argument, it wasn't just...
Well, I'm not going to the closing argument yet. I mean, obviously 703 gives everybody some flexibility in terms of testing an opinion. And if you look at the questions, they're not very well phrased, but...
That's true.
But It seems to be a 703 kind of an inquiry, poorly done. Now, if we go then to the closing argument, the language that you're mostly concerned about there is seems to go a little broader. They had an opportunity and they didn't kind of comments. So are you saying it's the closing argument that's the cherry on the top of this? Or what are you saying exactly?
That's one way to look at it. I think certainly the prosecutor bootstrapped his closing argument to the questions asked of Dr. Lance during cross-examination. And I think viewed under the totality of the circumstances, the cross-examination colloquy with then the prosecutor's closing arguments show that in its entirety, he was engaging in improper burden shifting.
What language precisely can you refer me to from the closing argument that would suggest that? If you could just show me a couple of sentences or something.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would be helpful. Where you think he stopped just simply discussing the foundation for the expert's opinion?
I think...
I have a little bit of it, and I was just reading through it, and I can't find exactly what you would be talking about, and I'd like to have you point me to the sentence or sentences that concern you.
I'm sorry. You know what? I will.
I think maybe on page 78 of the transcript that the defense attorney is saying something like, that's the extent of what he did. He reviewed some documents. That's the extent of what he did. That's all he did. And based on that, he said, basically, based on that analysis, it's not proven absolutely. And then maybe this is the sentence that concerns you. He didn't tell you about any analysis he did. He didn't tell you about whether he spoke to any of these people. All he told you is, I reviewed these documents. And maybe there's more, but could you help me with this, please?
No, Your Honor, I think that is the heart of what...
Is there something more... that you could want to put up in neon lights here and point me to?
I think that was very problematic because it then highlighted everything that he tried to bring out on cross-examination. And those statements to the jury really posited with them that the defendant, Mr. Santana, did not do anything to disprove.
And I understand it's a really subtle difference, but what is the difference there between just making a comment on the foundation of the expert's opinion? And I agree that you're saying that he's saying, well, he didn't do this, and that would probably be appropriate in terms of determining, you know, what he did look at, what he didn't look at. What more makes this a comment on the defendant's or a shifting of the burden?
To be honest, because the prosecution did not present any evidence of it. The prosecution did not present a CBI chemist to say, yes, I tested this, I used mass spectrometry, and it is, in fact, within a reasonable degree of scientific probability, crack cocaine. The prosecution never presented that evidence. So instead, what the prosecution did, they were left with having to attack the only expert witness who testified. So that, in my mind, that's what's so problematic, is because then the prosecutor shifting the burden to Mr. Santana to affirmatively prove something.
But we're obviously not saying that they can't attack a defense expert witness. They just have to do so appropriately.
Yes. In this case, again, what I find problematic, though, is there was no presentation of evidence other than a presumptive test that this was crack cocaine. And in fact, Dr. Lance testified that presumptive tests are good for screening out substances which are definitively not cocaine, so that you can't, beyond a reasonable doubt, say that this substance that Mr. Santana purportedly sold to the officer was in fact crack cocaine.
Seems pretty mild. And what do you make of this court statement here, page 79, line 21, the court, that's what I heard. He was talking about the evidence, and this gentleman didn't testify that he had checked anything. So is that a problematical statement on the court's part? I mean, the court's saying a mistrial is inappropriate. All the prosecution doing is giving you the status of the evidence.
Right. In other words, the trial court judge believed that this was appropriate and just mere comment upon the evidence.
Oh, but that goes to the point about, you know, allowing evidence in. Generally, the law favors that the evidence is let in, and then the trier of fact gets to determine, pursuant to the instructions, what to make of it.
Again, I think that the initial questions during cross-examination were improper, and if the questions during cross-examination were improper, certainly I think it's improper then for the prosecutor to bring it up again in closing arguments as in my opinion, after reading the prosecutor's closing arguments, he was attacked the defense expert, and he had to do that because the evidence showing that the subject...
So you're really saying it's the closing argument?
I think it's the closing argument bootstrapped with the questions asked on cross-examination. I think when viewed in its totality, a mistrial should have been...
Oh, here. Okay. That just puts on this expert right in the midst of the trial, right? And how precise does the prosecutor have to be? I mean, you're up there on your feet trying to ask questions. I mean, you're going to... This bright line test you want applied here? I mean, that is in the discretion of the court, right?
It is, but Mr. Santana has the constitutional right to a fair trial.
Okay, there. Now you got it. The question is whether it's a fair trial or not.
And okay. Because the prosecutor impermissibly shifted the burden to Mr. Santana to establish that the substance was not crack cocaine.
I'm just not seeing this in the actual transcript. I'm not seeing what you've just characterized it as.
I believe
the prosecution is not talking about the burden here. It's trying to elicit from the expert witness what he did and didn't do.
With all due respect, I guess we disagree because I believe that those questions posited, cross-examined to Dr. Lance did shift the burden to Mr. Santana to show that the evidence was not crack cocaine. And certainly the trial court disagreed. The trial court did not give limiting instructions. The trial court did not grant the mistrial. The problem is the prosecutor did not present evidence to show that the substance was, in fact, crack cocaine.
Did you even think that closing was okay if he did exactly what he did, but at the end of it he said, but I want to make clear, I'm not saying the defendant has the burden of proving this was not cocaine?
I actually think that things might have been different, that perhaps it would not be harmless, it would not be error, perhaps just be harmless error, because then the prosecutor is acknowledging to the jury that he does have that burden, but that did not occur in this case.
But it would still be error?
I believe there was error in this case, and it was constitutional error because of improper burden shifting. If the prosecutor had said that in the end, I could see where someone would say, yes, this is error. The prosecutor did engage in proper burden shifting, but because in the end he summarized and told the jury it was his burden, we're going to find it's harmless error and ultimately not an abuse of discretion.
Also, any different than the instruction that was given that actually gave that burden to the prosecution?
I think the problem was, though, Your Honor, is that it was just the standard jury instruction on the burden of proof. And that, in and of itself, I don't believe was enough to counteract everything that had happened at trial prior to that instruction being read.
But a personal acknowledgement by the prosecutor himself would make a difference.
Well, I think it goes a long way to, for someone who was attacking Mr. Santana's expert throughout trial and then during closing arguments, then to stop and somewhat acknowledge, having said all that, it is my burden. And that did not occur. Thank you. have a couple of things. I think that, again, when looked at in context, based on my reading of these statements, I think the prosecution never even thought that this would be a question that would show that the defendant had any duty to test. And I think if you look at the closing argument, there's nothing. It's a very short closing argument and simply says he didn't do anything that would help you more than what you already know. You already know that we have a presumptive test. There's nothing additional that this expert had told you that would either shift anything either any way. And I think by applying, to look at the standard of review, I think by applying the constitutional harmless standard first, as my opposing counsel suggests, I think you would eliminate the abuse of discretion review. Because if you find that any error was constitutional harm, or that it was error and of a constitutional dimension, you would necessarily probably determine that it would be reversible. And if you don't, then of course they didn't abuse their discretion. So I think you really need to apply that abuse of discretion standard first. And I just also think that, you know, especially in the context of all of this, I think the defense counsel anticipated the chemist was going to testify. And I think this is where all of these problems arose. The chemist didn't testify, isn't required to testify, and defense counsel could have, up to 10 days before trial, requested that the chemist testify so that he could have cross-examined her on her testing. And I think that's the problem that defense counsel got into and then decided to call this expert. And I find it troubling that a prosecutor couldn't rebut statements that an expert makes. I think that that's the core of impeaching a credibility of a witness, is how much they actually know. So if there are no further questions, the people would thank you for your time.
I just briefly, the record, did the defense lawyer cross-examine the cop about the weaknesses in presumptive testing?
Not to my recollection. I think it
was... You just testified the presumptive test. You used the word presumptive?
Exactly.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess. I thank both attorneys for their arguments, and the case will be submitted. We'll be in recess till tomorrow morning at 9.